So one of the themes for my residency is going to be the three refuges. It's going to be about this practice of taking refuge. Taking refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. And taking refuge, one of the interesting things about it, and some of you probably have noticed this, is that it's one of these practices that really is this thread throughout almost all the schools of Buddhism. And recently, I think for me, what I'm coming to really get a sense of is there's something really juicy. There's something really rich about this taking refuge. And a lot of times, you could say ritualistically, that's where the practice a lot of times begins, is kind of taking refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. But the more I get a sense of it, and the more I learn about it and practice it, the more I see that it really has the entire depth of this path within it. So during this residency, this is going to be one of the things that I want to explore with all of you. One is having these talks, these three talks around taking refuge, but then also for example, the meditation retreats, really putting it into practice, this taking refuge. And I think what you're going to see is there's just all these different levels to taking refuge. You know, usually, a lot of times, when there's a talk about taking refuge, or when you hear about it, you hear about the ritual of taking refuge. And I'm not going to be speaking so much about that. I'm going to be talking about it more in terms of this inner refuge and what that is. I think one of the other ways that this theme is going to fit in also is that with the other theme that we're going to be exploring during my residency for the study group. So the three refuges, taking refuge has a way of really setting the foundation so that the rest of this path of awakening can really unfold. It sets the conditions for something else to grow. Just like, you know, if you're going to plant a seed, you need the right conditions for it. You need the right soil, you need the right amount of moisture, you need the right temperature, and then eventually you need sunlight for that plant to grow. And those are the necessary conditions. And so for the study group, there's this teaching by the Buddha called Paticca-samuppada, which is usually translated as dependent origination. And what he's dealing with in this teaching is this whole idea of conditionality, of having the right conditions. And it's a fascinating teaching, actually. It's a little bit complex, too, so it'll be, I think, a really rich discussion if you want to come Tuesday night. And so we're just going to be exploring one of these specific conditions that's going to lead to this path that really allows our heart to be liberated. So as a way of beginning, I want to share with you kind of a simile that's used around the three refuges. One is just because I think there's a richness to it. And you'll see how the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha kind of fit together. And this is the way I'm going to start, tonight I'm going to be talking about the refuges kind of in a general way, and then talking about the first refuge, the Buddha, tonight as well. So the image that's given, and you might get a sense of this, which I think there's something really sweet about it, is that the Buddha aspect is like the sun. So it's like there's been this cold, dark night, and then the sun begins to rise over the horizon, and that sun is the Buddha. And then the Dharma is like, or the teaching of the Dharma is like those rays of the sunlight radiating out that dispels the darkness and also the cold of the night. And then the Sangha is all of those people that are really savoring and enjoying the warmth and the radiance of that sun. Two things about the simile that I'm struck by is, one is there's something really natural and organic about it. That's one of the things I want to point out about going for refuge. There's a natural and organic quality to this process. And I think the other thing which is so interesting is also the savoring of the things, the fruits of this practice. So I was thinking that the next step would be to kind of explore the kind of refuges that our minds seem to habitually take or habitually fall into. Because once we kind of see these false refuges, I think you'll get more of a sense of what I'm talking about when I'm talking about going for refuge, or the quality of these three refuges. Now, have you ever noticed what your mind kind of seeks solace in when life is difficult? Sometimes it's food, maybe TV. Maybe you get home and you surf the web. Maybe it's acquiring things. All of these are ways that the mind can seek a certain refuge. Have you noticed this? And just like, it's pretty obvious, isn't it? And the other thing about it is as I was mentioning, when we seek refuge in this way, even if it's habitual this way, when we're not directing the mind, these conditions have certain effects to them that are going to precipitate out of that. For example, I've just been reading about this really cool book. It's called The Brain That Changes Itself. Has anyone read this? It's about, I knew that Patty would have read it. It's about neuroplasticity, how the changeability of the brain, which is on one level a wonderful thing, really shows the potential that our minds have, and also shows some other aspects as well, especially around electronic technology, for example, TV and the internet and things like that. When we engage, for example, there's already been a lot of studies around TV, but now they're seeing it around the internet and things like that, and video games, how doing that hour after hour changes how our brain functions. It changes how our brain is actually organized. And there's a correlation that they're starting to find that with the increase in that technology, there seems to be this correlation of an increase in attention disorders. Not surprising. And I'm not advocating that we should kind of go back to the woods and forget about technology. But what I am advocating is that we're aware of the kind of conditions that we're setting up for our lives. Because really, that's a lot of this practice, is being aware of that and cultivating the conditions that really lead to awakening, that lead to the heart being liberated. Yeah, but it's not only those things that we take for refuge a lot of times. You know, sometimes it might be, you know, you have that to-do list, right? It's getting things done. Sometimes we take refuge in that. Maybe it used to be, it's probably dissolved now, as financial security, right? Poof. I think all of us realize how unreliable that is. And then there's all those stories, right? Have you noticed those stories that we take refuge in? Maybe it's the story, man, I am no good. Something's wrong with me. I need to fix myself. That's a story that our minds can take up, and then they make a project out of that, right? Or it could be opposite. I'm really great. I'm perfect. And then it's the same thing. It's taking refuge in this idea about who we are. Both are all these ideas about who we are. These are what I'm calling false refuges. Again, have you noticed that about your mind? Well, there might be some kind of project, right? A project that our minds take up. Maybe trying to be a likable person. You know, all of us want to be accepted, and sometimes that can bleed over into having this project of having this certain identity being projected out there. So we try to be a likable person. And that's actually a different project. It's a different way of walking in the world than this path. This path has a radically different way of walking in the world. It's about cultivating compassion, loving kindness, sympathetic joy, mindfulness. And that's different than the project of simply trying to be a likable person. again, that would be a false refuge, you could say. And I think it's important to notice how our minds can really seek out these false refuges. So I'm sure you're getting the sense now, you know, we're not finding a refuge in our thoughts. It's not some kind of thought, not in our worries or fears. We're not seeking refuge in some kind of identity. It's something different. So the first thing I want you to recognize about taking refuge is it's really reorienting our minds in a different direction. That's what we're doing. It's a reorientation. And I think what you'll see is it's going to be this reorientation in a different direction through this commitment to this practice. So the Pali word that's used for the three refuges is tisarana. T is just basically three, and then sarana literally means refuge or shelter. And what strikes me, I think, in order to explore this or begin to explore this, we have to think about what are we seeking refuge from? You know? What are the dangerous things out there that we need refuge from? What's dangerous out there? And it's interesting because it's, you know, the Buddha's not positing that what's really dangerous out there is not really like famine or disease or wars. It's nothing like that. What he comes to say is what the real danger is actually ignorance. That's the root of it. And then what spawns from ignorance, such as greed, hatred, and delusion. So that's the real danger that we're seeking refuge from. And again, as I was saying, it's a different kind of seeking refuge too. It's not like a seeking refuge in some God that's going to protect us or some person that's going to protect us. It's seeking refuge in our commitment to this practice or doing this practice. So it has that different feel. And I know it can be really helpful. I know that when I'm going through a difficult time in my life and I remember, this is where my real refuge is in this practice, in these three refuges, there can be something very empowering about it and very comforting in a different way than, you know, saying a prayer to something greater than myself. Something different than that. I think we'll get a sense of that through these talks that I'll be giving. There was an early commentator to the early Buddhist discourses. It was a monk by the name of Buddhaghosa, and he also gives this commentary on the three refuges. And it's really interesting, his interpretation of this word sarana, because it literally means refuge or shelter, but he likened it to this verb, this Pali verb sarati, which means to crush. And when I first read that, I was like, what's up with this? It's kind of weird, isn't it? To connect crushing, to crush something, with seeking a refuge. So what's up with that? And the sense I got from it, I actually came to appreciate this a little bit, in the sense of, I think seeking refuge is not only, you know, a lot of times when I hear this quality of seeking refuge, it has this quality of surrendering, which is a really important aspect of this practice. Surrendering, you know, the habitual ways I am in this world to kind of a more natural way. But I think there's also a time to have this kind of forward energy in our practice, a forward energy in our lives that has this, maybe this quality or this flavor of crushing. A lot of times you find it, the Buddha in the early discourses, you know, he's sometimes very clear, sometimes in a forceful way when he's explaining a point. There might be a place for that as well. There is a place for that. The other Pali word that's used around the three refuges is this Pali word Ti Ratna. And again, Ti is three, and Ratna means jewel, so the three jewels. And one of the reasons why this is used is that jewels were believed to have this protective power to them. So it has this protective power. But not only that, Ratna comes from this other word, Rati, which means to delight in. So taking delight. So these refuges are not something that we also seek shelter in, but that we actually delight in, that really opens and uplifts our heart. I think that the most important thing about going for refuge is to find how we are deeply moved by this practice. I think that's what's really important. And in order to get in touch with that, I just want to take you through an exercise or an exploration, a kind of an inner exploration, so we get more of a sense of it. And what I'm going to be inviting you to do is remembering kind of how maybe this practice or hearing about this practice or some aspect of the spiritual life has moved you or moved your life. So I want to invite you to just start to bring your awareness inward just for a little while. So either you might want to close your eyes or look down at the ground, whatever feels more comfortable to you. Just allowing your awareness to gradually arrive into your body. Noticing what helps with that, maybe having your eyes open or closed. You might want to now just feel the support of the chair or the floor. Feeling your body being supported. And now bringing your awareness to your limbs, feeling your feet and your legs, and your hands and your arms. And now bringing your awareness more inward. So what I mean by that is being aware of, for example, your throat, your chest, and your stomach, and your belly. And as you sense in there, I invite you to remember in what way this practice has moved you. You felt moved by it. So it might be a book that you've read that you really connected to. Or a phrase. Or maybe you have a sense of being moved in your spiritual life by another person. Maybe a friend who you really respect, or a monastic, or a spiritual teacher, or a spiritual friend, and being inspired by that person. And as you continue to remember, sensing inside, what comes with remembering right now, inside, the feeling in that? You might sense something in your body that comes with that. Or maybe there's been some kind of spiritual experience that's been deeply moving to you, that's changed your perspective, or changed your life in some way. Or maybe it's noticing how doing this practice or living a spiritual life has helped you in a difficult time in your life or with a difficult situation. Or maybe directly witnessing how this has transformed you. Whatever feeling comes with all this, just keeping it company. Good. Nice. And now if you can just gradually begin to bring your awareness back into the room here. Just coming back into the room and letting go of this exercise now. Were you able to get some kind of sense of that being moved? And what I mean by that is a bodily sense, really feeling that. Literally feeling some kind of movement. I feel that this is so important. You know, for this practice to really unfold, we need to be in contact with that which moves us. I think it's essential. That's when our spiritual life is really going to unfold. Then we're not doing it because we think it's a good idea or because somebody told us to, but because we're being moved. The phrases that are used when one goes for refuge in Pali being the early Buddhist scriptural language, you know, Buddhang, Saranang, Gacchami. And this last word, Gacchami, comes from this verb gacchati, which means to move forward, to go forth. So there needs to be this quality of movement. So it's got to have this juicy quality of being moved. And I think that's my biggest hope with these talks, is that somehow you'll start to get a sense of some kind of personal connection with this taking refuge, going for refuge. So it personally means something to you in a way that moves you. So I invite you, you know, tonight and for the rest of these talks, just to hold this question, you know, what is going for refuge in the Buddha and the Dharma and Sangha? What does that mean for you? So I offer these thoughts more as things to reflect on so that you can find that connection of being moved. So the first refuge, going for refuge in the Buddha. So I'm going to be, again, talking about this on different levels. On the surface level, it's going for refuge in the historical Buddha, you could say. So going for refuge in the fact of his awakening, the fact that he talked about this path and explained this path to awakening. It's taking refuge in the possibility of awakening. So that's one level. And I think one of the interesting things about this level, which I find fascinating, is that really what that relies on is not so much taking refuge in if the Buddha existed or not, but really taking refuge in this idea that awakening is possible. So there was this, actually this Buddhist scholar, Paul Williams, who pointed out that Buddhism is actually quite different than other religions, like especially if you compare it to traditional Christianity, you know, if it were somehow could be proven that Jesus never existed, that could really blow a big hole in Christianity. If it were proven that the Buddha never existed, it doesn't really matter, actually. What matters is that awakening is possible. If it was just a story, it doesn't matter. There was a scholar, a Buddhist scholar, that I think that was in Thailand, that was saying to this Thai monk, you know, this scholar's opinion was, it looks like a lot of the earlier discourses weren't actually spoken by the historical Buddha. And the Thai monk said, well, whoever spoke them, that was the Buddha. I love that flexibility around that. So sweet. But I think there's also a deeper level to taking refuge in the Buddha, and that's taking refuge in our own ability to wake up. And I can't emphasize this enough. You know, so many times I come across, which is fine, but still, I come across this idea in practitioners of, oh, I'm going to practice, but awakening, that's not for me. That's for somebody else. Maybe it's for those monastics in Thailand or in Burma. But me, I can't wake up. That's not for me. And I can understand it. There's a lot of health benefits to meditation and things like that. But there's something more, too. And a lot of times there's this feeling that I'm not enough. I can't do that. That's not a possibility for me. I like the teachings, but that's just something that's not for me. And I think we're really shortchanging ourselves when we do that. And I want to read to you a quote from actually Annie Dillard. It's from her book, Holy the Firm, which I feel like it really speaks to this. So she begins, she says, "Who shall ascend into the hill of the Lord? Or who shall stand in his holy place?" So I feel like here she's just using Christian language, but asking the same question. Who can wake up? Who can really wake up? And she says, "There's no one but us. There's no one to send, nor a clean hand, nor a pure heart on the face of the earth, nor in the earth, but only us. A generation comforting ourselves with the notion that we have come at an awkward time, that our innocent fathers are all dead, as if innocence had ever been. But there's no one but us. There never has been." Do you hear what she's getting at here? The people that have woken up are just like us. It's not like they were any more perfect than us. And really, when it comes down to, that's all there is just us. It's people like us that wake up. And yet we have this false notion that she speaks to, right? You know, the idea that there's these innocent fathers, as if there had been something like innocence. And we hold on to these notions that so that awakening or liberating our heart is something out there. So I think it's very important to dispel that belief, to notice that we have this possibility. And the more we can do that, the more we're actually taking refuge. That's another way of taking refuge in Buddha, in the Buddha, taking refuge in that possibility. And in some ways, I think you can just see the practice as that, just taking refuge in that. There's a story in the Lotus Sutra, which is a sutra from the Mahayana tradition, about a son. So the son runs away when he's quite young from his father and is gone for like 30 years. During that time, his father has moved to another village and becomes this great, wealthy, prosperous, powerful king. And the son, during those 30 years, is just having these jobs of basically kind of menial jobs of hard labor. And the son comes into the village where his father is now residing after 30 or 40 years, looking for work, and his father recognizes him. Ah, there's my son. And so he sends his servants out to bring his son to him, and his son is completely frightened. His son says, "What did I do? I have done nothing wrong. Let me go." And so the king says, "Just let him go for now." And instead what the king does, because he's realizing how much fear is really in his son, that he instead hires his son. He has some other servants go out and say, "Okay, we want to hire you. We'll pay you double the wages and we'll give you some place to live." So his son comes to his palace and begins to work there, just digging ditches and things like that, and lives in some small room. And he's doing this kind of menial labor at his father's palace for about 15 years. And during this time, his father's really gradually making this connection, really coming to befriend his son so his friend can just get used to him. And then, right before the father dies, it's like the son is ready to really hear what the father has to say, which is, "You are my son, and all of this is yours." So it's like the path of the son was really about capacity, right? It's really about just having the capacity to see this wakeful quality. That's all it is. Capacity. A lot of times when we're sitting and we're meditating, that's one way of understanding what we're doing, is we're just developing this capacity for something that's much greater than we can even understand. So again, it's taking refuge in that possibility of awakening. Taking refuge in this practice of developing capacity, just like this son, so that we can come to see like he did in a way that's quite profound. And there's a deeper level. Again, another story. One day the Buddha was walking along this road, and there was a Brahmin by the name of Dona. And Dona sees the Buddha pass by. He's really impressed by just how the Buddha is walking. And after the Buddha passes by, he looks down on the dirt road and looks at the Buddha's footsteps. And he's just amazed by him, because in the heel of the Buddha's footsteps is this wheel. And he is so impressed by the footsteps of the Buddha. He is deeply moved by how the Buddha is walking in the world, how the Buddha is actually touching the world. So seeing footsteps like that, he's thinking, what's up with this? This is pretty cool. I've never seen footsteps like this before. So he follows the Buddha into the forest and comes to the Buddha and basically asks, what's up with the footsteps? Wow. Those are some footsteps. I've never seen anything like it. Are you some kind of god? And the Buddha's like, No. Well, then you must be, Dona says, well, then you must be some kind of celestial being, like a deva or something like that. I mean, I've never seen anything like that. And the Buddha says, no, I'm not a celestial being. And then Dona asks, well, are you a human being? And the Buddha says, no. And then Dona asks, well, what are you then? And the Buddha says, I am awake. I am awake. I think there's some quite interesting things about this story. First of all, I think it points out something that's really important about going for refuge in terms of this practice. That really what we're doing is we're reorienting, as I was saying, reorienting the direction that our minds are going in, so that we learn to walk in the world in a different way, in a profoundly different way. And that we end up touching the world in a different way. We leave a different mark. So I think really that's what this practice is about. Leaving a different mark by the way we touch. By the way we connect. Because that's what the Buddha was really embodying. And he did it by resting in a different place, right? He wasn't resting in being a human being. Not resting in being a man or a woman. Or somebody with this name or that name or this kind of story. It was resting in wakefulness. Resting in awareness. I think that is almost the essence of taking refuge in the Buddha, is to begin to rest in wakefulness. Because that's what we're beginning to do, especially in the meditation, right? Have you noticed that? You come to the meditation and you start to be aware of the feeling of your breathing. Awareness of hearing a sound coming and going, of a thought or an emotion. It's not identifying with that thought or that emotion. It's more resting in the awareness of it. Resting in that witnessing. And the more we practice, the more that gets stronger, right? And a lot of times when we start to rest in that wakefulness, you can start to get a sense of that, just that wakefulness. You know, even while you're listening to my voice right now, sometimes you can just get a sense of that wakeful quality, that quality of awareness. You know? You're sitting here and there's this witnessing of the sound of my voice coming and going. It arises and it passes away. So sounds parade by right now in this awareness. Sensations parade by as you're just sitting here. It's not like you have to do anything. There's this awareness of sensation. Thoughts parade by. Feelings parade by. And there's that awareness. And that awareness is not an object, right? If it's an object, then it's just an object of your awareness. But there's something different than just in that resting in awareness right now. Resting in that wakefulness. Like, for example, the sound of my voice, noticing how it comes and it goes. But that wakefulness might have a different quality than coming and going. Might have a different quality than being here or there. Might not have a quality of even of any kind of friction or suffering to it. And there might be a quality of radiance to it. Sometimes you can just get a taste of that. Not even doing anything. That's beginning to rest more and more in that wakefulness. So in essence, I think taking refuge in Buddha really covers all those different levels. Till we really begin to rest like he did in awake, in wakefulness. So may all of us come to rest more and more in wakefulness as a way of taking refuge. So, thank you. Are there any questions or comments or thoughts about any of that?
Did you say in the story, in the footsteps? So did he see the wheel? You said there was a wheel in this, or is that
in the heel?
Samsara wheel? Is that
actually
that?
The Dharma wheel, I think it,
oh,
it
the
is.
The wheel of Dharma?
The wheel of
okay.
Dharma.
Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. In the heel.
Yeah. I'm thinking of how Eckhart Tolle writes about presence, and he likes to point out that there is nothing but this present moment. There's no place else to take any refuge. Anything else is an idea. The idea of a Buddha is different from this moment that is here, here right now. And the idea of a Sangha, a community, and the images we have of how nice it is to be with a bunch of people and how they're going to smile at me and be friendly, or images we may have of how they're going to be critical of me and not like me. This is all imagery. And as you pointed out so nicely, this is where we usually take refuge is in the imagery. But imagery, why is that false refuge? Because it's just pictures. If we see that imagery is doesn't relate to reality, and that it also it blocks us from seeing and being and feeling in this moment here.
Yeah.
And if this moment doesn't feel adequate, then one can really question, what's the inadequacy? What is possibly missing right now and right here? This is the only place that there is.
Thank you.
In that story, I've never understood why he says, no, he's not a human being. Because we're always being told that he was a human being.
Yeah.
He was, you know, just like us. If he can attain enlightenment, so can we.
Mm-hmm.
So why would he say he's not a human being?
I think he uses it as a really good teaching moment, because it's about where are we resting. Are we resting in being a human being, or are we resting in wakefulness? And so I think it's a really good teaching to Dona that there's something different going on here. And you're trying to categorize, it's almost like the Buddha saying, you're trying to categorize where I'm at, you're trying to catch me. And I really can't be caught in that way. And so I think that's where he's going to. And probably another time he'd say, yeah, I'm a human being. I think there's a usefulness of coarse language, but I think there's a use in what he's doing with Dona as well.
Yeah. If we really look carefully at what we mean by a human being, I say, I'm a human being. That's all I know, just a human being. But if one looks really carefully at that, one finds that it's not what one thought, that a human being is not just a human being. It's much, much more.
And I think one of the interesting things about this path in terms of a lot of these ideas, like taking refuge in the Buddha and the Dharma and the Sangha, is this: you can start to recognize this use or this skill of using concepts as a way of bringing us to this non-conceptual experience. So it's this real, almost this beautiful dance that we can be led upon, I think, a lot of times when we start to get a sense of some of these teachings. And I think that's the quality of refuge that's also really sweet too, is just really following something rather than having to know about it, following the surrendering quality, which I think can really lead in that way.
I appreciate what you said early on about this being awakening, being something available to us, not to someone else, or not necessarily later. I like the idea of I don't have to have this belief that it's not for me or it's for someone else. I like that.
Mm-hmm.
I happen to be reading one of the discourses, some of the early students, I think there's a reference, they didn't have so much dust in their eyes. Mm-hmm. They have less dust in their eyes. I think that's very interesting, that I can be awakened with still some dust in my eyes.
Yeah.
I don't have to be later after I do all this.
Yeah.
Purify this, do that.
Yeah. Important thing to remember, especially on a day like today. Right? Phew. Can even happen in Albuquerque. Great. Well, thank you very much.